to Henry Mancini, please. Sunday night, and that means from high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jefferson Valley, New York, the John Mack Radio Show is on the air. Good evening, this is John McMullen, John Mack to some, welcome you to the 207th episode of the weekly John Mack Radio Show. The links to recordings of the previous 206 shows may be found at www.johnmack13.com under the radio show tab. And John Mack is J-O-H-N-M-A-C, so that's www.johnmack13.com. In addition to the previous radio shows, you'll also find links to my online daily newspaper at my web home. The newspaper is a curation of news articles from around the country and the world, articles relating to opinion, politics, sports, entertainment, books, the environment, and technology. Try it and subscribe. It's free and only one email per day, and that's www.johnmack13.com. But I hope you'll join us not only tonight, but every week, 7 p.m. Eastern Time on Sunday evenings, live, or as most do, listen later. Next Sunday, my guest will be professor, reporter, and author of the 2015 book, An Unlikely Union, The Love-Hate Story of New York's Irish and Italians, Paul Moses. Now, to this week's show, the 207th, as I mentioned, callers may call him at any time during the show by dialing 646-716-9756. And that's 646-716-9756. I usually hold callers until near the end of my interview with my guest. My guest tonight is poet, storyteller, world traveler, the radio show host, Bill Bushell. In addition to the background I just mentioned, Bill is also the host MC of the monthly open mic night at the wonderful Hudson Valley Ride Center in Sleepy Hollow, New York. And that is where I first came across Bill. Good evening, Bill. And welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, John. I appreciate it. What a great entrance to have Peter Gunn bring us in.
All right. Speaking of the radio, before we get in at the beginning of your biography, your radio show is hosted on Hellenic Public Radio. Is Greek your own ethnic background?
No, actually, I'm the only person on the air for Hellenic Public Radio who is not a Greek or Greek American, and that's just the way it's been. As when people ask me about that, I always say, I wasn't born Greek in this lifetime, but certainly in a different lifetime.
That's interesting. The one of the writers' groups that I go to weekly, I heard the term that I hadn't heard before, IBM, Italian by marriage, people that weren't Italian who married into the Italian families. So we all have some connection to a different ethnicity, perhaps. Where did you first grow up and then go to early school?
Well, I grew up in Harrison, New York, where I still live, and went to Harrison High School and then went to Lafayette College.
Do you remember what your earliest aspirations were?
Yes, I wanted to be a detective. I remember reading the Hardy Boys and thinking, boy, what a great life it would be to be a detective.
Do you remember the first time you wrote anything?
Ooh, wow. I can't offhand think. of anything. But I was brought up with books because my father worked in a bookstore, and I was virtually brought up in a bookstore. So, you know, writing was always in my blood.
Was it the Westchester bookstore, or was it in the city, or where?
It was in Westchester. It was in Larchmont. It was called Anderson's Bookshop. In fact, it's still called Anderson's Bookshop, but we sold it back in 1990, 91.
Oh, so there is the bookstore in Larchmont. Most of the local bookstores have closed. I'm glad that it's hanging in there. So.
Well, when we owned it, our aspiration was always, you know, bring them on. You know, the bigger the better. We'll take you on and we'll do better.
Yeah, when the big chains, the Barnes & Noble, I remember when Barnes & Noble was one store that sold mainly textbooks back to people down that 18th Street. But as that grew and then Borders, and they could offer coffee and a bigger inventory and everything like that, it looked like the handwriting started to go on the wall, and then obviously Amazon took many of them out. But I understand that in many parts of the country, the independent bookstores just starting to come back.
So, yeah, I know, I can't think of there's one in Denver that's Tattered Cover, I think is the name of that one. And then there's the big one out in, where is it? Portland, Oregon, I think. I can't think of the name of that one either. But the independent bookstores, if they're really good, they will hold their own.
Long Island has a big one that writers go, well-known writers, after that, they bring the book out. Oh, what'd you major in at Lafayette?
Well, I started as a religion major, thinking I was going to go into the ministry, but then I ended up switching that and ended up with a double major, English and history, and they gave me all my religion credits as history credits.
Yeah, what did you plan to do with that? I was an English major, and I was lucky enough to get swept into technology early, and because all I could do with English was go on to be an academic, or I could teach high school. What was your plans with English ministry?
Well, I had no plans. In fact, when I graduated from college, my mother asked me, what are you going to be? And I looked at her, and the only answer I had was a graduate.
Yeah, I started as a philosophy major, and then I saw there weren't many jobs for philosophers, so I switched to something much more practical, English literature. And then what did you do after college?
Well, I managed a warehouse for a couple of years, and then what did I do after that? That might have been when I went into the family business. No, I went into construction for a while and worked on multiple jobs renovating houses.
Did you write while you were in high school or in college for a newspaper?
No, not for anything specific, but I did write in college, primarily because I had to, because I was an English major. It was in college. Well, I had two major learning experiences for writing, and college was certainly one of them, because I was doing so poorly in my classes that I was given a tutor. And the tutor didn't actually teach me how to write. He taught me how to think. And that was a huge difference in the way I approached writing.
I know that early on you got into world travel. How did you manage that?
Well, my first big trip to Europe, I was actually working on a book on tattooing. And I'd gone out to St. Paul, Minneapolis for a tattoo convention, and everybody said, well, if you're here, you got to go to the big international one in Amsterdam. It was in Amsterdam. So that's back when Freddie Laker was doing the Laker flights. And so for, I think it was like $250 round trip, I got to fly into England. And then I got to the continent and went to the Amsterdam Convention. And then I decided that I wanted to stay in Europe for a little bit longer. And there were two other things I wanted to do. One was to go to the Holy Mountain in Greece, and the other was, I can't remember what the other was. Stonehenge.
Oh, okay. So you were just stayed both in Britain and then you went off to Greece, two of the famous places. What brought the interest in Greece, and what is the Holy Mountain? I never heard of the Holy Mountain.
The Holy Mountain is Mount Athos, which is actually a protectorate of Greece. It isn't actually a part of Greece, though it is. It's a peninsula up in the northern part of Greece near Thessaloniki, and it's a monastic community. There are over a dozen monasteries there, and they're not just Greek Orthodox. There's also Russian Orthodox and... Oh, I forget what the other one is, but they're monasteries and skites, which are like little communities that aren't in a building. And then there are a lot of monks who just live in the caves in the Holy Mountain. And a friend of mine had visited there and told me about it. And I said, you know, that's some place I have to visit.
I've spoken to people who have been to the Isle of Iona, and they think that's a life-changing experience, with the Book of Kells was kept, and it was originally obviously Roman Catholic, and now it's, I believe it's a, it's the Presbyterian monastery, or an Anglican monastery. When you had planned to be a minister, what denomination were you involved with?
Well, I was brought up Episcopalian. I was actually baptized Lutheran, but I never was in a Lutheran church again until like 20 years later. But my father was Episcopalian, and so that's where I went for services, and I actually taught Sunday school there also.
And how long did you spend on this initial European trip to Stonehenge
That was just under 6 months, like 5.5 months, give or take a week here or there, and it was a life-changing trip.
Did you give up your interest in tattooing along the way?
No, I still have many friends in the world of tattooing, and I've always said that if I am going to ever finish writing that book, because I have tons of photographs and everything, that the last chapter would be me getting a tattoo.
Ah, okay. And then what did you do when it came back to the States?
When I came back to the States, that's when I think I went into the family business, started working in the bookstore. I had worked in the bookstore.
And how did you...
Oops, sorry.
No, go ahead.
Now, I'd worked in the bookstore when I was in high school. You know, that was my summer job. But it was never my intention to be a merchant. But eventually I took over running the bookstore after my father retired.
And was that when you got into the radio business also, or did that come later?
Well, that sort of came later. One of the results of my first trip to Europe was I found out I was a storyteller, because I came back from the trip and I would go out to dinner with friends, and 3 hours later we'd still be sitting there and I'd be telling stories. And, you know, at some point I decided that I wanted to do storytelling on the radio. And I was taking a playwriting course, and I met this woman whose husband was involved with Hellenic Public Radio, and she was about to get involved, and they were looking for English language announcers. And I had been writing a play about a radio station, and this woman approached me and said, "Do you have any interest in doing radio?" And I was like, "Yes, definitely."
And where is the radio station located? And because I'm not familiar with it, and I'm a radio buff, really.
Well, we broadcast out of Astoria. Our signal is 91.5 FM WNYE. And, of course, like everybody else these days, we can be also heard online at cosmosfm.org.
Now, WNYE, that's public radio. That's the Board of Education station, isn't it?
Yep, that's exactly what it is.
Okay, yeah, it's and they share the number of the NPR feeds to the news and everything, which is interesting. And when is the show on, Bill?
I'm on every other Thursday night. Matter of fact, I'll be on this Thursday night, the 5th of October, at 7 p.m. Hellenic Public Radio has the 7 to 8 p.m. slot on WNYE every weeknight. And then we have, I forget how many hours over the weekend. We have a bunch of hours on both Saturday and Sunday, but I, off the top of my head, I can't tell you what hours we have on the weekend.
Most of the ethnic shows that I'm familiar with also are Fordham University, WFUV, has a whole bunch of them, Irish and various Eastern European. I didn't realize that there were others in the area. And
yeah, NYE
and
actually has quite a few.
And what's the thrust of your show? Is it an interview show? Travel? What is the?
It's arts oriented. I do lots of interviews with poets and writers and filmmakers and translators, and I used to do a lot of storytelling on air also. I haven't done actually any stories in a while, but I used to rewrite and present myths and legends on the air.
I noted that one of your interviewees on the show list is the Frank Miller. Is that the great comic book writer?
That's right. When 300 came out, I managed to do an interview with him, and it was interesting because he's not one who does interviews normally, but I think Dark Horse is the publisher of 300, and they managed to get him to do the interview, which was a lot of fun because he's an odd fellow.
He was a big Marvel writer, and he was known early in his career for Daredevil. He did terrific Daredevil.
So, yeah, and then he's probably best known now for his Batman stuff, because he did all the Batmans who were like older Batmans. And matter of fact, I think he has a new one coming out of that whole Batman genre of the older Batman, the tired, worn out Batman.
It's interesting how we normally don't think of well-known writers doing comics up until the dawn of the graphic novels. But one of my favorite mystery writers, Max Allen Collins, did Dick Tracy for years, and I think he did some Batman too.
Could be. Yeah, it's funny because Batman, I've been reading comic books since I was 6 years old, and Batman has always been my favorite personality of all the comic book characters.
Well, my CB handle was Captain America when I was at CB. I was a Captain America person, but I was also a what I really liked, and DC was the first to do it, was the crossovers, the world's finest comics, with Superman, Batman, and then they expanded that to the Justice League and everything. So and my son is interesting. My son is a screenwriter, and he almost did a series with Stan Lee for a while. Marvel had kind of frozen Stan Lee out of the movie business and everything, and he was gathering attorneys until all of a sudden they took him back in and everything. So the series never got done, but my son got to hang around with Stan Lee, which was pretty cool for him, I think.
Oh, I'm sure. He's quite an interesting fellow. I mean, he shows up in all the Marvel films, and he must be making money hand over fist these days.
Yeah, he didn't used to. I mean, they were timely comics, and then he took it over. But comics really didn't. The dawn of the superheroes came with Superman and everything. You know.
And then they 38 were 38 and 39 Batman. Yeah. So.
Yeah, and it's interesting how for a long time the families of the creators, both of Superman and of Captain America, had to really fight for recognition, the Jack Kirby's and the Jerry Siegel's and whoever.
Schuster and Siegel. I mean, they were blocked out of making any money. And I think they sold the rights to Superman for like $400 back then, which back then was a lot of money. But, you know, for what Superman became, it was pretty incredible how badly they were treated. Now, you know, DC is trying to, well, sort of make up for it. But, you know, they're both dead. But the families are at least getting something from the recognition now.
Right. How long has the show been on? Your show?
25 years.
And do you never feel that it gets stale at all? How do you
well,
keep it?
Well, that's a really interesting question. There was a period of time where it probably got a little bit stale, but I do enough different types of things that, you know, and I pick and choose what I want to do. Basically, if I, you know, I go to the library and I check out to see what books are new that might be interesting, and, you know, connect with the publisher and then connect with the authors, and, you know, it's the stuff that I like, so it doesn't really get stale anymore, because I'm you know, totally running the show pretty much, and I get to pick and choose what I want to do.
That's why I do this show, because I like talking to interesting people, and since I'm not making any revenues and it's costing me money, I get to choose who I'm going to have, and I get to contact them, and I've had a Sir Perezky is one of my favorite mystery writers, and I had the writers and poets and everything, and the poet laureate wherever she was, Alecki Barnes of Missouri, and you know, just interesting folks, college presidents, and I enjoy talking to interesting people.
Yeah, and it's interesting because it always amazes me how approachable people are. You know, you think a lot of these people just aren't interested in talking to you because you're not a major person on ABC or CBS or NBC, but it always amazes me how really approachable and positive people are about doing interviews.
Now, you've continued to travel. You mentioned in one of your notes to me that you're called for a long time to the world travel. How do you fit in your traveling out the shows?
Well, I don't travel that much anymore. It's just just more difficult these days as I've gotten older. Well, like I was in Hawaii a couple of years ago, and I actually called into the station and did the show from Hawaii.
Is there any place that you haven't been that you'd like to be since you've
yes.
you've cut back on your
travel? Well, many places, but the two places I definitely want to go to are the pyramids in Egypt and Jerusalem. Those are two places that I still have on my bucket list of places to visit.
I have the friend who has the book out, who's probably waiting in the wings because he calls in a lot. Who had as the merchant seamen had delivered beer to people from my old neighborhood in Vietnam during the war. Then he's been back. He got stuck there during the Tet Offensive as a civilian, and he's been back, and he's going back this year. And it was interesting. Julie McCarthy from NPR was on 2 weeks ago, and they were both saying how that when you go back to some place that you like to see how it's progressed, but you wish it was how you remember it, you know. And they're two contradictory contradictory statements.
Yeah,
have you gone back to place and surprised
yeah.
that it's changed, or you haven't been quite as happy?
Well, I've certainly had that experience with Greece. When I was there in 78 the first time, Greece was, I won't say it was a third world country, but it certainly had its difficulties back then. But you know, since then, the last time I was there was 2004, right after the Olympics, and it's certainly a much more modern country now. But there's still a magic in Greece. It's just a wonderful place, and you don't see ocean that color anywhere else.
Were you there long enough to get caught up in the politics with Cyprus and with Turkey and everything, and to form any opinions on what should happen, if anything, there?
No, not really. And I have a hard enough time following politics in the United States, so I try to stay out of the politics in other parts of the world. So,
in addition to the radio show, you have a number of varied artistic endeavors over the years. Let's go through a few. You did a poetic photo essay on the first Obama inauguration for Artsy Spectrum magazine. Tell us about that, please.
Well, I can't remember how I actually got that off the ground, but I was down in I went down for the inauguration, and my cousin lives in Maryland, so I got to stay with him and take the subway into to Washington. And I don't know if you remember the first inauguration, but it was brutally cold. And
right.
I just went and took a ton of pictures, and for some reason I decided that I wanted to make a comic book out of it. And so I did, and I happened to send it to a friend who runs a gallery down in Soho. I can't think of the part of New York, Chelsea. And she liked it so much that there's the magazine Artist Spectrum is part of the organization she works for, and she suggested that they publish it. And to the best of my knowledge, I know up to that point it was the only article that they ever published that wasn't directly about an artist that they were showing at the gallery, and it was also not an artwork per se, but they liked it enough that they published it. And but it was so brutally cold, and I was there with my nephew, And it was it's a day I'll never forget for many reasons, especially just being there for the event. But boy, what a cold day.
What kind of equipment did you use? Were you close enough that you could get a good heads up, or do you have a heavy telephoto, or what did you,
no,
what
actually,
did you wind up using?
Boy, I can't remember what camera I had back then. I can't remember what camera I had then. But basically, it wasn't pictures of the people on the podium. It was pictures of people in the crowd, the people watching the inauguration. And I mean, I was on the mall with, I think they said it was 1.5 million people. That day.
Not as many as Donald Trump had. He's had more than anyone in history.
Well, according to him, yeah. But it was an incredible experience, just because the positive energy was just unbelievable. And I remember reading accounts afterwards how there were no incidents of violence that day. You know, there were over a million people on the mall, and the police never had to calm any incidents down.
Have you kept up this type of work since then? Have you done anything else like it?
Not really. I've done a few things, but just, you know, for my own personal enjoyment, but never really, you know, tried to do anything for publication again. But it's an interesting thing to do a comic book. It's a totally different way to approach communicating, and I totally admire people who do comic books for that reason. It is an art form, and I know here in America we don't look at comic books as art forms until recently. I think it's finally getting that status. But you know, when I was a kid, comic books were looked down upon as trash, basically.
Yeah, it was really Will Eisner, the spirit guy, who really took that platform and ran with it until he was praised, I remember, for all his works about the inner city in lower Manhattan. And I think it really took off then, you know, the graphic novels and everything.
Yeah, and then Neil Gaiman with The Sandman. That was the recent thing that really sort of took comic books and put it on the map as an art form here in the United States, at least.
Yeah. He's done very well, and obviously his novels and everything else, you know.
Yeah.
You've also gotten into screenwriting, and you did the film that premiered at the Big Apple Film Festival in 2010. Was based on your screenplay. Tell us about that, how you got into that, and to what the story was and everything.
Well, I have a friend who is an artist, a visual artist, a graphic artist, and she put together this film, and we talked about it, and she said, you know, she wasn't a writer, that she needed a script, and so I basically wrote a script for her, and she put her artwork to it, and she came up with that. That was, I think that one was called Chi Chi Artist, and that was a 5-minute film. And then we worked on another film a couple of years later, and which was about her mother had died, and her mother wanted her ashes spread in Italy. In Florence, and it was basically the story of she and her family going to Florence and spreading her mother's ashes.
Now, you're also continue that. Don't you also have some other film projects in progress?
Yeah, I have one that I've been working on for much too long. unfortunately, my computer is old and rickety, and I have to save up some cash so I can buy a new computer so I can finish editing this film. So one of these days, I hope I have enough cash that I can go out and buy a new Mac and finish the edit on it. But yeah, it's a musical. Musical noir quest film with paper bag puppets, and it's called.
So you're doing not only the screenplay, but you're also doing the actual film work for it, huh?
Well, my friend Chi-Chi and I are doing the film work. It's all filmed and everything, but I'm doing all the voices. And the singing and all of the voice work for it. So yeah.
Another field that you've gotten into is what I'm currently involved in, poetry. When did you start writing poetry? And how would you describe your work if you are comfortable even describing it?
Sure. Okay. How did I get involved in it? Well. Actually, when I started doing the radio show, my training is actually in storytelling, but I would have poets on the radio show, and every once in a while, either my opening or closing would, according to these poets, be very poetic. And what really triggered it was I was the first person back on the air for Hellenic Public Radio after 9/11. And I knew I had to do something very special as an opening. So I actually went down and visited the site on the 1st of October, as a matter of fact, and came back and opened up my very first show, which was like a week later, I think. And I happened to be interviewing a poet that day. And afterwards, after I did my opening, she leaned over to me and said, "You know, with a little work, that could be a great poem." And later I got it published, and the rest is history. Narrative poetry is my because I'm a storyteller, I've always said some stories are better told as poems. So that's what I do.
Where was it first published, Bill?
I'm sorry, what?
Where was it first published? You say it was your first poem published. Where did you have it published?
In a small book. I can't remember the name of it, but it was published by Uganda Press. It was actually a number of poets up in Stamford, Connecticut. There's a place in Stamford called Curly's Diner, and every Tuesday night, poets gather in the diner and read their poetry, and there's critique, and it's still going on, you know, 20 years later, we're still doing it. And that's where a bunch of us put our poems into this collection.
I go every week to the group that meets in the Mayapak Library, the Mayapak Writers Group, and the fellow that's organized it, he's been doing it for 20 years also. You know, I think that's interesting how people keep coming back to write and they keep doing other things. The reason I asked the question was the first thing I've had published, I don't even remember where, it was the contest. I graduated, as I mentioned, as an English major, and not only hadn't I written a poem from graduation day until the late 1990s, I hadn't read one. And I was walking through my local Barnes & Noble, and I saw a title of the book by Charles Bukowski that looked interesting, so I picked it up. And I read a few poems, and I said to myself, this guy's crazy that I could do this. And then I happened to write a poem, and I showed it to one person, and for some reason, it was the only poem I ever wrote. I entered in a contest. And a fellow called me up to congratulate me, winning fourth prize in this national contest, and I got $25, and this is to Poet Grand Writers Magazine. And That was the best thing that ever happened to me, or was the worst thing that ever happened, because it just became an obsession, you know. So,
oh, yeah.
Would you like to read something to us?
Sure. In fact, the poem I'm going to read, the title is Sitting by the Fire, after Bukowski.
Oh, wow.
Beer in hand, I sit by the fire. Blinding shades of green, lightning bugs fill the yard. My flashlight's beam catches shadows moving, hiding from the day. There, secrets make me weep. Breeze, more wood, fire-fed, red flame and heat. Rejoice. Grace is called for, hoped for, proffered, and rejected. The price too high. Lightning bug violence guide deer across my yard. Their dead eyes inspect the stains on my shirt. Laughing, they continue their journey through my yard, through my life, through the yard next door. Their contempt makes me smile. Laughter soothes the savage, the breast, and the beast. Six times six times six hides in those shadows. John of Patmos lurks there too. So does the Christ. Hallelujah! Wretched are the blessed as they reach for another beer.
That's like Bukowski without misogyny and the sex and the booze.
Right.
Yeah.
I love Bukowski. I mean, he was such a wild man.
Yeah. I have everything that he's written that I could put my hands on, and in some cases, since they started publishing things by theme, I have the same poems in different books too.
Yeah, I know.
Over the years, you've told stories, lectured, then read poetry in New York City, Westchester, Lower Connecticut, even Dartmouth College. How'd you get on to that circuit, and are you still appearing in such places?
Well, I haven't really done anything on the road recently. I don't know. A lot of it happened at storytelling conventions. I was invited to do a class that I used to do called Storytelling on the Radio at one or two different conventions. A couple of things I did down at Cornelia Street Cafe down in the village. People I know were involved down there and invited me to come down and read. It's a great venue. I don't know if you've ever been there, but it's a fabulous venue. That's probably the last place that I did anything, and that was probably just about a year ago. And that was the last thing that I've really done on the road that hasn't been on the radio.
I noticed that one of the subjects that you dealt with in touch venues was the death of your sister. It seems to me that would have been very difficult. How'd you do it? And was it cathartic for you?
It's interesting because my sister died in 1979, and it's been something that I've written about ever since, in one form or another. So it's very cathartic, but it's a topic that's always there, It was very difficult because I first started writing about it while it was happening, while everything was happening. And I realized that not only was there a lot of sadness, but there was also a lot of humor and a lot of humanity that was going on around me at that time. So I thankfully was aware of it as it was going on. So I was able to write about it. And actually I came in honorable mention in the Writer's Digest writing contest one year because I submitted it as a nonfiction piece for that. And it was honorable mention, as I said. So it's been something that's, you know, will always be with me and always part of my experience as far as writing.
Okay. As I mentioned, I met you at the Hudson Valley Writers Center. How did you get involved there?
Well, I took a couple of courses there, but I've been going to the open mic as a participant for many years, and then I stopped altogether, and then I started up again, and one night they didn't have anybody to lead it. This was 3 or 4 years ago, and actually the woman who was running it at the time approached me and said, "Would you be the timekeeper?" Which, as you well know, I do quite well these days. And I said no, because it's no fun when you have to tell somebody to get off the stage, basically. But finally I relented and I said, sure, I'll do it. And so I sort of became the host, and then I stopped for a while and somebody else took over, and then the woman who took over had to leave, and somebody else was running the center at the time and asked me. I mentioned that I had been doing it before, and they said, well, would you like to do it again? And that was 3 years ago, and I've been doing it ever since.
Yeah, I used to go regularly to read there, and the fellow named Bob was the person who was running the time then, the 5 minutes, and the dais used to be against the window. It was just the opposite. And then I was teaching 4 nights a week, and I just wasn't getting there on the Friday. And the same group also meets on another Friday in Peekskill at some place that I'd forgotten all about until someone reminded me of it. But since I cut back on my teaching, now I'm back regularly. So I mentioned that it's a wonderful place, unique in its wide range of courses, programs, and services to write. Is how would you describe the center?
Yeah, I mean it's a wonderful place. If you want to work on your skills as a writer, there's no place better. They have many courses on writing poetry, writing memoir. I know they have one coming up that's sort of a mixed media type thing, poetry and memoir and, you know, all the different branches together. And in fact, I'm working on a piece about Alexander the Great that has all different sorts of has poetry and nonfiction and fiction and all sorts of different things involved. And also physically, it's just an incredibly beautiful setting. It's an old train station that sits right on the Hudson River and doesn't get much better than that.
Yeah, it's extremely nice. You mentioned the open mic session and keeping time. You have to run a tight ship to maintaining the schedule, the 5 minute period. We had one incident just last month of having to cut someone off. Do you find that very difficult?
I used to. No, it's not pleasant when you have to, you know, tell somebody that, you know, it's time, you know, and if someone has to run over a little bit, I let them go a little bit, but it's just not fair to everybody else who's sitting there, especially, you know, if we have 15, 20, 25 people who want to read that night, it gets to be a really long night. One night we had like 30 people, and I didn't get out of there until almost midnight by the time I cleaned up afterwards and everything. So, it you know, you have to run a tight ship, and, you know, and again, it's just not fair to everybody else. And so, you know, you have to make sure that people toe the line.
With the many interests that we've talked about so far, how did you look at yourself? To what do you see as your primary focus?
Well, that's part of my problem. I don't have a primary focus. I mean, I think of myself as a writer. I think of myself as a filmmaker. I think of myself as a radio host, but I also have a regular job. And, you know, so I like doing them all. And thankfully, I've been able to do them all, not for financial success by any means, but I feel very happy that I've been able to do all the different things that I've been able to do in my life.
We didn't even get into that. What is your regular job?
A friend of mine owns property up in Greenwich, and I sort of take care of the books and help him do various jobs here and there. But, yeah, that's what puts the bread on the table and the bread in the pocket. But it's my true loves are, you know, the radio show and the open mic, and when I have the chance to write, you know, those are the things that make me want to get up and keep on going.
Oh, we have a caller on the line, and it's the aforementioned Chick Donahue, whom I mentioned, who's traveled all over, was in Vietnam, currently has a book out on the longest beer run in history. Good evening, Chick, and you have a question for Bill.
Good evening, John, and I'm enjoying listening to your conversation between yourself and Bill, and I spend a lot of time in Greenwich. That's the first thing, and I love to travel. I'm excited about my life now. I'm 76, and I've done a lot of traveling. I've had an interesting life, and I found out at the age of 72 that I lived my life with dyslexia, and at the same time, I just started the book, and it was interesting to rediscover my life from my mind. And knowing of my dyslexia now, it explains so many things that I had done during life that I just never knew why I did it that way. I surprised so many people, including myself, almost every day. Somebody asked me once, how did you know you had dyslexia? Well, I said, if I would have, and I never did have a resume. My entire life, I never once had to write out a resume. But if I wrote it out right now and just dealt with my educational experiences and records, I would have three items down there. One would be a diploma from Good Shepherd Grammar School, a GED while in the Marine Corps in Asia, and a master's from Harvard, and an MPA from Harvard, the Kennedy School of Government. That alone should have clued me in that there was something different about me. But I've enjoyed it. I've enjoyed going back over life, and like Bill has been speaking about all of the varied things he did. I did lots of exciting things, I thought, at the time. I've enjoyed it. It's great fun. I enjoy now telling my grandchildren about it. Even so, sometimes their grandmother and their mother says, Dad, why do you have to tell them that? and I say, because I think they have to know. Not everything goes according to schedule. And who knows? I had no idea what I was going to do at 16, 26, 36, but at that time I had three kids, so I knew what I needed to do, not what I wanted to do, and opportunities came about, and I grabbed them and ran with them and had so much fun, but it's the freedom. It's the freedom of not being pigeonholed in one career. It's the freedom of doing what you're comfortable doing and getting personal satisfaction out of it. And money, while it comes, it's necessary to take care of those three children and a family, it's not the driving force. It's the pleasure of doing things that you like to do. And I hear that in Bill. I hear that in Bill's story, and thank God for it. My life has been very good, enjoyable. I'm having great fun right now, sitting down here in hot Florida, listening to John every week and his guests.
Hallelujah.
Bill,
hallelujah.
Bill, the background, Chick was a high school dropout, then was a Marine, a merchant Marine, owned a bar, was the Sandhog, got to go to Harvard on a for his master's, was an official of the Teamsters Union, was the Sandhog again, was retired. Then when they found out that someone looted his pension, went back to being the Sandhog. Now he's retired and lives in Florida Island and then with his daughter in Connecticut. So he's just as you went over for a short time to Europe and decided to stay for a while, Chicks had the advantage of being able to hop back and forth, as did I, going from English to technology to teaching to writing to radio. So we've all been lucky.
Hallelujah. We should all be so lucky.
Yes.
Where have you been, Bill, that we haven't mentioned? We're beyond Europe and Hawaii.
Morocco. I love Morocco. It was such a special place. And Scotland. Scotland, well, all of the British Isles, but Scotland is... There are a few places in the world that I truly believe there's still magic in the soil, and Scotland is certainly one of them.
And Chick, of course, you like Ireland and Asia. Is there any other place that's magic to you?
They're my favorites, but the whole world is magic. I like Italy. I really do like Italy. I never thought I would. But there's some places in Italy that are totally different from Ireland, but naturally beautiful. This past year, I was in Malta. And Greece again. I like Greece, and I love Croatia. I'm still discovering places, but I do like going back to the places I've been to in my youth. And I just like to stand in my old neighborhood, stand on a street corner where I grew up, and look at the building and remember all of the people and the different families. Some of them refugees from the war. Who lived there. And I just like looking back. It was great fun. And looking forward to going back to Vietnam in January and spending a week in Saigon and going back to my old haunts and exactly 50 years to the day of the Tet. And I'll be at the embassy that morning, this 50 years later, exactly to the hour. Mm. I like things like that. I really do. And I have to say, John, you know, a lot of us in Inwood, where we grew up, went to Good Shepherd School. Six of the Dunnehughes went there. It was all tuition free then. And a couple of my classmates who graduated with me from there in 56 run the Good Shepherd, Friends of Good Shepherd, Good Shepherd School. And they decided to use a fundraiser to bring me back, to read from my book and to speak for an hour or so and to show a video about my experience. And as you know the story, John, the experience was about me and the neighborhood. I went over to see four guys who grew up in that neighborhood, three of them of whom went to Good Shepherd School. And they're all alive. They all came back from the war. It's 50 years later. And we're all back in the same auditorium where we learned how to dance and grew up in. It was like our living room.
We didn't learn how to dance, Chick. Bill,
yes,
we've covered a good deal of ground tonight. What else would you like the audience to know about?
Geez, I can't really think of too much else other than the fact that I do have a couple of blogs that I write. I do a daily one, which is called Things We Need to Make It Through the Day. And then I do a blog for the radio show, which is called Just My Eyes. And I also do other things on that blog also, but that's primarily the one that I put all the information for the radio show on.
You'll send
that,
me everything there, and put it in the article that I'll out to everyone. What's next for you?
Well, we got the open mic coming up on the 20th, and I have a show this week on the 5th. So those are the immediate future. Other than that, I'm planning on selling my houses and hopefully retiring within the next few years and be able to do some more traveling and more writing and more filmmaking and more loving of life.
Do you plan to stay in the area when you retire?
I don't know. I'm actually thinking that I might do one of those mobile small houses and actually being able to travel in my house.
Okay. Chick, what happened to your Florida place? Was there any problem? Did you have any from the hurricane?
There were some problems. The power was out for about a week. The elevators are still on and off, and it still goes out once in a while. But the real damage around where I live here in Pompano Beach, I live in a huge apartment building. It's that's what it is. So it's concrete and it's well protected. But there was a lot of tree damage, a lot of water damage. But my particular place, not that much damage at all. I happened to be in New York when it happened, so I spent an extra week there. Actually went out to Long Beach and spent some time on the beach in Long Beach instead of Pompano Beach. But not much damage.
Someone keeps calling in from the 718 area code, but they keep dropping out. Bill, I suspect they wanted to talk to you, but they're not there. So, thank you very much, Bill. It's been a real pleasure. At the range of your compliments, of your accomplishments and interests, are impressive.
Well, thank you. I've really enjoyed this. I have to admit, I went in with a little trepidation because, as I mentioned to you before the show started, I felt the tables were being turned on me. I'm usually the one asking the questions.
And, Chick, thanks for joining us again. And
thank you, Jim.
A bit of commercial information. My books are available on Amazon, and I blog at medium.com and publish the daily paper mentioned earlier. And I also read at the Hudson Valley Writers Open Mic that Bill is the MC of on the third Friday night of the month. And Hudson Valley Writers Center is in the Philipsy Manor train station in Sleepy Hollow, New York. Send any comments or questions to me at johnmack13@gmail.com. And in the words of Mets radio announcer, as Howie Rose, as we wind down this season, put it in a book. I hope you'll join us next week for my interview with Paul Moses and every other week thereafter. And I think I'll take us off with peace tonight with Nora Jones.
Daffodils have their fun.
Thank you for listening.
Where the cares of the day seem to slowly